understand you. Think of this first principle of attunement as persuasion jujitsu, using an apparent weakness as an actual strength. Start your encounters with the assumption that you're in a position of lower power. That will help you see the other side's perspective more accurately, which in turn will help you move them. Don't get the wrong idea, though. The capacity to move others doesn't call for becoming a pushover or exhibiting saintly levels of selflessness. Attunement is more complicated than that, as our next principle is about to demonstrate. Principle 2. Use your head as much as your heart. Social scientists often view perspective-taking and empathy as fraternal twins, closely related but not identical. Perspective-taking is a cognitive capacity. It's mostly about thinking. Empathy is an emotional response. It's mostly about feeling. Both are crucial. But Galinsky, William Maddox at Anciad Business School in Fontainebleau, France, and two additional colleagues have found that one is more effective when it comes to moving others. In a 2008 experiment, the researchers simulated a negotiation over the sale of a gas station. Like many real-life negotiations, this one presented what looked like an obstacle. The highest price the buyer would pay was less than the lowest price the seller would accept. However, the parties had other mutual interests that, if surfaced, could lead to a deal both would accept. One-third of the negotiators were instructed to imagine what the other side was feeling, while one-third was instructed to imagine what the other side was thinking. The remaining third, given bland and generic instructions, was the control group. What happened? The empathizers struck many more deals than the control group. But the perspective takers did even better. 76% of them managed to fashion a deal that satisfied both sides. Something similar happened in another negotiation situation, this one involving a set of thornier and more conflicting issues between a recruiter and a job candidate. Once again, the perspective takers fared best, not only for themselves, but also for their negotiation partners. Taking the perspective of one's opponent produced both greater joint gains and more profitable individual outcomes. Perspective takers achieved the highest level of economic efficiency without sacrificing their own material gains, Galinsky and Maddox wrote. Empathy, meanwhile, was effective but less so and was at times a detriment to both discovering creative solutions and self-interest. Traditional sales and non-sales selling often involve what look like competing imperatives, cooperation versus competition, group gain versus individual advantage. Pushing too hard is counterproductive, especially in a world of caveat venditor, but feeling too deeply isn't necessarily the answer either, because you might submerge your own interests. Perspective taking seems to enable the proper calibration between the two poles, allowing us to adjust and attune ourselves in ways that leave both sides better off. Empathy can help build enduring relationships and diffuse conflicts. In medical settings, according to one prominent physician, it is associated with fewer medical errors, better patient outcomes, more satisfied patients, fewer malpractice claims, and happier doctors. And empathy is valuable and virtuous in its own right. But when it comes to moving others, perspective taking is the more effective of these fraternal twins. As the researchers say, ultimately, it's more beneficial to get inside their heads than to have them inside one's own heart. This second principle of attunement also means recognizing that individuals don't exist as atomistic units, disconnected from groups, situations, and contexts. And that requires training one's perspective-taking powers not only on people themselves, but also on their relationships and connections to others. An entire field of study, social network analysis, has arisen in the last 15 years to reveal these connections, relationships, and information flows. In most sales situations, however, we don't have the luxury of the deep research and fancy software that social network analysts use. So we must rely less on GPS-style directions and more on our intuitive sense of where we are. In the world of waiters and waitresses, this sort of attunement is called having eyes or reading a table. It allows the server to quickly interpret the group dynamics and adjust his style accordingly. In the world of moving others, I call this ability social cartography. It's the capacity to size up a situation and in one's mind draw a map of how people are related. I do this in every sales situation, says Dan Shimmerman, founder of Verisent Software, a blazingly successful Toronto company recently acquired by IBM. For me, it's very important to not just have a good understanding of the key players involved in making a decision, but to understand what each of their biases and preferences are. The mental map gives a complete picture and allows you to properly allocate time, energy, and effort to the right relationships. Social cartography, drawing that map in your head, ensures you don't miss a critical player in the process, Shimmerman says. It would stink to spend a year trying to sell Mary only to learn that Dave was a decision maker. Nonetheless, attunement isn't a merely cognitive exercise. It also has a physical component, as our next principle of attunement will show. Principle 3. Mimic strategically. Human beings are natural mimickers. Without realizing it, we often do what others do, mirroring back their accents and speech patterns, facial expressions, overt behaviors, and affective responses. The person we're talking to crosses her arms, we do the same. Our colleague takes a sip of water, so do we. When we notice such imitation, we often take a dim view of it. Monkey see, monkey do, we sniff. We smirk about those who ape others' behavior or parrot back their words, as if such actions somehow lie beneath human dignity. But scientists view mimicry differently. To them, this tendency is deeply human, a natural act that serves as a social glue and a sign of trust. Yet they too assign it a non-human label. They call it the chameleon effect. In an award-winning study, Galinsky and Maddox, along with Stanford University's Elizabeth Mullen, tested whether mimicry deepened attunement and enhanced the ability to move others. They used the same scenarios as in the previous study, the gas station sale and the negotiation between a job hunter and a recruiter, but added a new dimension. 5 minutes before the exercise began, some of the participants received an important message that gave them additional instructions for carrying out their assignment. Here's what those instructions said. Successful negotiators recommend that you should mimic the mannerisms of your negotiation partner to get a better deal. For example, when the other person rubs his or her face, you should too. If he or she leans back or leans forward in the chair, you should too. However, they say it is very important that you mimic subtly enough that the other person does not notice what you are doing. Otherwise, this technique completely backfires. Also, do not direct too much of your attention to the mimicking so you don't lose focus on the outcome of the negotiation. Thus, you should find a happy medium of consistent but subtle mimicking that does not disrupt your focus. Strategic mimicry, as I call it, proved to be effective. The participants told to mimic, again, with just 5 minutes of notice and preparation, did it surprisingly well and to great effect. In the gas station scenario, negotiators who mimicked their opponent's mannerisms were more likely to create a deal that benefited both parties. In the recruiting scenario, the mimickers fared better than the non-mimickers and did so without adversely affecting the other side. The researchers titled their paper, "Chameleons Bake Bigger Pies and Take Bigger Pieces." The reasons, Galinsky explains, go to our very roots as a species. Our brains evolved at a time when most of the people around us were those we were related to and therefore could trust. But as the size of groups increased, it required more sophisticated understandings and interactions with people, he told an interviewer. People therefore look to cues in the environment to determine whom they can trust. One of those cues is the unconscious awareness of whether we are in sync with other people, and a way to do that is to match their behavioral patterns with our own. Syncing our mannerisms and vocal patterns to someone else so that we both understand and can be understood is fundamental to attunement. Other research demonstrates mimicry's effectiveness. For example, a Dutch study found that waitresses who repeated diners' orders word for word earned 70% more tips than those who paraphrased orders, and that customers with servers who mimicked were more satisfied with their dining experience. In a French study of retail salespeople, half of the store clerks were instructed to mimic the expressions and nonverbal behavior of their customers, and half were not. When customers approached the salespeople for help, nearly 79% bought from mimickers, compared with about 62% from non-mimickers. In addition, those who dealt with the mimickers reported more positive evaluations of both the sales clerk and the store. A Duke University experiment in which an interviewer presented what purported to be a new sport drink found that when people were subtly mimicked, they were more likely to say they would buy the drink and to predict that it would be a success. And much as perspective taking and empathy are fraternal twins, mimicry has a first cousin, touching. The research here, much of it by French social psychologist Nicolas Guigen, is similarly plentiful. For instance, several studies have shown that when restaurant servers touch patrons lightly on the arm or shoulder, diners leave larger tips. One of Guigen's studies found that women in nightclubs were more likely to dance with men who lightly touched their forearm for a second or two when making a request. The same held in a non-nightclub setting when men asked for women's phone numbers. Yes, both studies took place in France. In other research, when signature gatherers asked strangers to sign a petition, about 55% of people did so. But when the canvassers touched people once on the upper arm, the percentage jumped to 81%. Touching even proved helpful in our favorite setting, a used car lot. When salesmen, all the sellers were male, lightly touched prospective buyers, those buyers rated them far more positively than they rated salespeople who didn't touch. Of course, mimicry, like the other attunement behaviors, requires deftness. When people know they're being mimicked, which was exceedingly rare in the experiments, it can have the opposite effect, turning people against you. Twisting the dial towards someone else's perspective doesn't mean claiming you've been to the place your prospect just vacationed or that your uncle lives in her hometown. That's not attunement. That's lying. The key is to be strategic and human. To be strategic by being human. Gwen Martin understands that. She began her career as a salesperson and in 2007 co-founded NumberWorks, a staffing agency headquartered in Minneapolis that provides accountants and financial professionals to organizations that need help with complex projects. The company is one of the fastest growing in its industries, and one reason, I had heard, was Martin's sales prowess. So on a trip to Minnesota and in a subsequent phone interview, I asked her what qualities were necessary in effectively moving others. At the time, I'd not yet encountered the research that I just described. She knew nothing of it either. Martin surprised me by repeatedly using a word one rarely hears in this context, humility. The most common thread in the people who are really good at this is humility, she told me. They take the attitude of, I'm sitting in the small chair, so you can sit in the big chair. That's perspective taking through reducing power, the first rule of attunement. Martin also said that top salespeople have strong emotional intelligence, but that they don't let their emotional connection sweep them away. They are curious and ask questions that drive to the core of what the other person is thinking. That's getting into their heads and not just their hearts. Attunement rule number two. Most of all, you have to be able somehow to get in sync with people, to connect with them, whether you're with a grandmother or the recent graduate of an MBA program, she told me. How does she describe this capacity? This might sound strange, she said, but I call it the ability to chameleon. The ambivert advantage. Extroverts make the best salespeople. The reasons are clear from the very textbook definition of this personality type. Individuals high on extroversion are characterized as sociable, assertive, lively, and sensation-seeking. Moving others requires interacting with others, and social situations, which can drain the energy of introverts, is something extroverts relish. Extroverts' comfort with other people also means they don't shrink from making requests. And such assertiveness helps, whether you're convincing a prospective client to hire your public relations firm or asking a stranger to switch seats on a train. Extroverts are friendly and gregarious, which means they're more likely to strike up the lively conversations that lead to relationships and ultimately, perhaps, to sales. Finally, extroverts, by their very nature, seek stimulation, and the energy and enthusiasm that bubbles up can be infectious, not to mention conducive to many forms of influence and persuasion. Sociable, assertive, lively, and sensation-seeking. It's the ideal profile for moving others. Salespeople represent the prototypical extroverts in our culture, many analysts say, the very embodiment of the extrovert ideal that shapes Western society. Little wonder, then, that extroverts often pursue careers in sales, that most sales guides extol outgoingness and sociability, or that research confirms that managers select for this trait when hiring a sales force. The notion that extroverts are the finest salespeople is so obvious that we've overlooked one teensy flaw. There's almost no evidence that it's actually true. When social scientists have investigated the relationship between extroversion and sales success, they've found the link, at best, flimsy. For instance, while supervisors often give extroverts high ratings, several researchers have found that extroversion has no statistically significant relationship with sales performance, and that extroversion is not related to sales volume. One of the most comprehensive investigations, a set of three meta-analyses of 35 separate studies involving 3,806 salespeople, found that the correlation between extroversion and sales was essentially non-existent. Let me explain what that correlation means. Positive correlations are measured on a scale that goes from 0 to 1, with a higher number, say 0.62, indicating close correlations, and 0, no correlation at all. Across the 35 studies, the correlation between extroversion and sales performance was a minuscule 0.07. Does this mean that introverts, those soft-spoken souls more at home in a study carol than at a cocktail party, are better at moving others? Not at all. In fact, the evidence, which is emerging in new research, reveals something far more intriguing. Adam Grant is a management professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School and one of America's top young social psychologists. Some of his previous research had examined extroversion, and he'd become curious that a trait so widely associated with sales didn't have much connection to success in that realm. So he decided to find out why. Grant collected data from a software company that operates call centers to sell its products. He began by asking more than 300 sales representatives to complete several personality assessments, including one that social scientists use to measure where people fall on the introversion-extroversion spectrum. This particular assessment lists statements such as, "I am the life of the party," and "I am quiet around strangers," and asks participants to rate themselves on a 1-7 scale, with their answers resulting in a numerical measure of extroversion. Then, Grant tracked the sales representative's revenue over the next 3 months. Perhaps not surprisingly, introverted sales reps didn't perform as well as extroverted ones, earning an average of $120 per hour in revenue compared with $125 per hour for their more outgoing colleagues. But neither did nearly as well as a third group, the ambiverts. Ambiverts? These are people who are neither overly extroverted nor wildly introverted. Go back to that 1-7 introversion-extroversion scale. Ambiverts sit roughly in the center. They're not ones or twos, but they're not sixes or sevens. In Grant's study, these Goldilocks personalities, not too hot, not too cold, earned an average of nearly $155 per hour, easily besting their counterparts. In fact, the salespeople who had the highest average revenue, $208 per hour, had extroversion scores of 4.0, smack in the midpoint. What's more, when Grant plotted total revenue over the 3 months against employees' scores on that 1-7 scale, he found a distinct and revealing pattern. Indeed, revenue peaked between 4 and 4.5 and fell off as the personality moved toward either the introvert or extrovert pole. Those highest in extroversion fared scarcely better than those highest in introversion, but both lagged behind their coworkers in the modulated middle. These findings call into question the long-standing belief that the most productive salespeople are extroverted. Grant writes, "Instead, being too extroverted can actually impair performance, as other research has begun to confirm. For example, two recent Harvard Business Review studies of sales professionals found that top performers are less gregarious than below average ones, and that the most sociable salespeople are often the poorest performers of all. According to a large study of European and American customers, the most destructive behavior of salespeople wasn't being ill-informed. It was an excess of assertiveness and zeal that led to contacting customers too frequently. Extroverts, in other words, often stumble over themselves. They can talk too much and listen too little, which dulls their understanding of others' perspectives. They can fail to strike the proper balance between asserting and holding back, which can read as pushy and drive people away. The answer, though, isn't to lurch to the other side of the spectrum. Introverts have their own, often reverse challenges. They can be too shy to initiate and too timid to close. The best approach is for the people on the ends to emulate those in the center. As some have noted, introverts are geared to inspect, while extroverts are geared to respond. Selling of any sort, whether traditional sales or non-sales selling, requires a delicate balance of inspecting and responding. Ambiverts can find that balance. They know when to speak up and when to shut up. Their wider repertoires allow them to achieve harmony with a broader range of people and a more varied set of circumstances. Ambiverts are the best movers because they're the most skilled attuners. For most of you, this should be welcome news. A few of us are extroverts, a few of us are introverts, but most of us are ambiverts, sitting near the middle, not the edges, happily attuned to those around us. In some sense, we are born to sell. Here's the sample case, a set of tools and tips and exercises for Chapter 4 on attunement. First, discover the best way to start a conversation. Everything good in life, a cool business, a great romance, a powerful social movement, begins with a conversation. Talking with each other one-to-one is human beings' most powerful form of attunement. Conversations help us understand and connect with others in ways no other species can. But what's the best way to start a conversation, especially with someone you don't know well? How can you quickly put the person at ease, invite an interaction, and build rapport? For guidance, look to Jim Collins, author of the classic Good to Great and other groundbreaking business books. He says his favorite opening question is, "Where are you from?" The wording allows the other person to respond in a myriad of ways. She might talk in the past tense about location, "I grew up in Berlin." Speak in the present tense about her organization, "I'm from Chiba Kogyo Bank." Or approach the question from some other angle. "I live in Los Angeles, but I'm hoping to move." This question has altered my own behavior. Because I enjoy hearing about people's experiences at work, I often ask people, "What do you do?" But I've found that a few folks squirm at this because they don't like their jobs or they believe that others might pass judgment. Collins's question is friendlier and more attuned. It opens things up rather than shuts them down. And it always triggers an interesting conversation about something. Second, practice strategic mimicry. Gwen Martin says that what makes some salespeople extraordinary is their ability to chameleon, to adjust what they do and how they do it to others in their midst. So how can you teach yourself to be a bit more like that benevolent lizard and begin to master the techniques of strategic mimicry? The three steps are watch, wait, and wane. Step one, watch. Observe what the other person is doing. How is he sitting? Are his legs crossed? His arms? Does he lean back, tilt to one side, tap his toe, twirl his pen? How does he speak? Fast, slow? Does he favor particular expressions? Step two, wait. Once you've observed, Don't immediately spring into action. Let the situation breathe. If he leans back, count to 15, then consider leaning back too. If he makes an important point, repeat back the idea verbatim, but a bit later in the conversation. Don't do this too many times, though. It's not a contest in which you're piling up points per mimic. Step 3, wane. After you've mimicked a little, try to be less conscious of what you're doing. Remember, this is something that humans, including you, do naturally, so at some point it will begin to feel effortless. It's like driving a car. When you first learn, you have to be conscious and deliberate. But once you've acquired some experience, you can proceed by instinct. Again, the objective here isn't to be false. It's to be strategic, by being human. Subtle mimicry comes across as a form of flattery, the physical dance of charm itself, the New York Times has noted. And if that kind of flattery doesn't close a deal, it may just be that the customer isn't buying. Third, pull up a chair. Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon.com, has accomplished a great deal in his 48 years. He's reshaped the retail business. He's become one of the 30 wealthiest people in the world. And with far less fanfare, he's devised one of the best attunement practices I've encountered. Amazon, like most organizations, has lots of meetings. But at the important ones, alongside the chairs in which his executives, marketing mavens, and software jockeys take their places, Bezos includes one more chair that remains empty. It's there to remind those assembled who's really the most important person in the room, the customer. The empty chair has become legendary in Amazon's Seattle headquarters. Seeing it encourages meeting attendees to take the perspective of that invisible but essential person. What's going through her mind? What are her desires and concerns? What would she think of the ideas we're putting forward? Try this in your own world. If you're crafting a presentation, the empty chair can represent the audience and its interests. If you're gathering material for a sales call, it can help generate possible objections and questions the other party might raise. If you're preparing a lesson plan, an empty chair can remind you to see things from your student's perspective. Attuning yourself to others, exiting your own perspective, and entering theirs is essential to moving others. One smart, easy, and effective way to get inside people's heads is to climb into their chairs. Fourth, get in touch with your inner ambivert. Wharton's Adam Grant has discovered that the most effective salespeople are ambiverts, those who fall somewhere in the middle of the introversion-extroversion scale. Are you one of them? Take a moment to find out. Visit the following link, www.danpink.com/assessment, where I've replicated the assessment that social scientists use to measure introversion and extroversion. It will take about 5 minutes to complete, and you'll get a rating when you're done. If you find you're an ambivert, congrats on being average. Continue what you're doing. If you test as an extrovert, try practicing some of the skills of an introvert. For example, make fewer declarations and ask more questions. When you feel the urge to assert, hold back instead. Most of all, talk less and listen more. If you turn out to be an introvert, work on some of the skills of an extrovert. Practice your ask in advance so you don't flinch from it when the moment arrives. Goofy as it might sound, make a conscious effort to smile and sit up straight. Even if it's uncomfortable, speak up and state your point of view. Most of us aren't on the extremes, uniformly extroverted or rigidly introverted. We're in the middle. And that allows us to move up and down the curve, attuning ourselves as circumstances demand and discovering the hidden powers of ambiversion. Fifth, have a conversation with a time traveler. Kathy Sallet, whom you'll meet in Chapter 8, has an exercise to build the improvisational muscles of her actors that can also work to hone anyone's powers of attunement. She calls it Conversation with a Time Traveler. It doesn't require any props or equipment, just a little imagination and a lot of work. Here's how it goes. Gather a few people and ask them to think of items that somebody from 300 years ago would not recognize. A traffic light, maybe. A carryout pizza. An airport screening machine. Then divide into groups of two. Each pair selects an item. One person plays the role of someone from the early 1700s. The other has to explain the item. This is more difficult than it sounds. That person from 300 years ago has a perspective wildly different from our own. For instance, to explain, say, a Big Mac bought from a drive-thru window requires understanding a variety of underlying concepts. Owning an automobile, consuming what 300 years ago was a preposterous amount of meat, trusting someone you've likely never met and will never see again, and so on. This exercise immediately challenges your assumptions about the understandability of your message, Salat says. You are forced to care about the worldview of the other person. That's something we all should be doing a lot more of in the present. Sixth, map it. Walking a mile in another's shoes sometimes requires a map. Here are two new varieties that can provide a picture of where people are coming from and where they might be going. The first is what I call a discussion map. In your next meeting, cut through the clutter of comments with a map that can help reveal the group's social cartography. Draw a diagram of where each person in the meeting is sitting. When the session begins, note who speaks first by marking an X next to that person's name. Then, each time someone speaks, add an X next to that name. If someone directs her comments to a particular person rather than to the whole group, draw a line from the speaker to the recipient. When the meeting is done, you'll get a visual representation of who's talking the most, who's sitting out, and who is the target of people's criticisms or blandishments. You can even do this for those increasingly ubiquitous conference calls. In fact, it's easier because no one can see you. The second type of map is what I call a mood map. To gain a clearer sense of a particular context, try mapping how it changes over time. For instance, in a meeting that involves moving others, note the mood at the beginning of the session. On a scale of 1, meaning negative and resistant, to 10, meaning positive and open, what's the temperature? Then, at what you think is the midpoint of the meeting, check the mood again. Has it improved, deteriorated, remained the same? Write down that number too. Then do the same at the very end. Think of this as an emotional weather map to help you figure out whether conditions are brightening or growing stormier. With attunement, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Seventh, play mirror, mirror. How attuned are you to slight alterations in appearances and situations? This team exercise, a favorite of change management consultants, can help you answer those questions and begin to improve. Gather your group and tell them to do the following. 1. Find a partner and stand face to face with that person for 30 seconds. 2. Then, turn around so that you're both back to back with your partner. 3. Once turned around, each person changes one aspect of his or her appearance. For example, remove earrings, add eyeglasses, or untuck your shirt. Now, this is important. Don't tell people what you're going to ask them until they're back to back. Then wait 60 seconds. Step 4. Turn back around and see if you or your partner can tell what has changed. 5. Repeat this twice more with the same person, each time altering something new about your appearance. When you're done, debrief with a short discussion. Which changes did people notice? Which eluded detection? How much of doing this well depended on being observant and attuned from the outset? How might this experience change your next encounter with a colleague, client, or student? 8th, find uncommon commonalities. The research of Arizona State social psychologist Robert Cialdini, some of which I'll discuss in Chapter 6, shows that we're more likely to be persuaded by those whom we like. And one reason we like people is because they remind us of us. Finding similarities can help you attune yourself to others and help them attune themselves to you. Here's an exercise that works well in teams and yields some insights individuals can later deploy on their own. Assemble a group of 3 or 4 people and pose this question. What do we have in common, either with another person or with everyone? Go beyond the surface. For example, does everybody have a younger brother? Have most people visited a Disney property in the last year? Are some people soccer fanatics or opera buffs or amateur cheesemakers? Set a timer for 5 minutes and see how many commonalities you can come up with. You might be surprised. Searching for similarities, hey, I've got a dachshund too, may seem trivial. We dismiss such things as small talk, but that's a mistake. Similarity, the genuine, not the manufactured variety, is a key form of human connection. People are more likely to move together when they share common ground. Chapter 5. Buoyancy. On Wednesday morning, the day after he'd sold about $150 worth of carpet sweepers and cleaning products to two San Francisco lawyers, Fuller Brushman Norman Hall returns to their office to deliver the goods. But when he arrives, the lawyers have not. So Hall and I retreat to a break room situated in the corner of the building's seventh floor. The room is the aggressively generic sort of space you find in many office buildings. A small kitchen setup against one wall, a cheap table surrounded by cheaper chairs in the room's center. But it gives us a place to park, and there we sit, chatting about Hall's life, waiting for his customers to show up so he can give them their loot and get on with his day. About a half hour into our conversation, a woman who works down the hall enters the break room and begins preparing a small pot of coffee. When her back is turned, Hall signals with a raised index finger that he wants to interrupt our conversation to begin one with her. "Are you the new office down the way?" he asks. "We are," she says, turning her head, but not her body, to respond. "I've been calling on these two attorneys here for many, many years, and I was going to introduce myself," Hall says. "I don't know whether there's much interest, but I've been covering this area of the city for almost 40 years. The woman, her back still turned and her voice devoid of even a fleck of emotion, says, "Uh-huh." "I'm sure you've heard of Fuller Brush," Hall begins. "Yeah, she replies. She's uncomfortable. And it's clear that the encounter has become a game of beat the clock. Will her coffee finish brewing before Hall gets fully into his sales pitch? "I don't think we have any need." Drip, drip, drip. "I don't press myself on people," Hall assures her, calm in his voice and time on his side. Drip, drip, drip. "Okay," she says in the sing-songy rising intonation of someone trying to end a conversation. "Thank you." Hall pretends to be oblivious. "I carry the home catalog, and then I do supply certain offices with minor cleaning items. That's why I'm here," he says. She turns, crosses her arms, and alternates her gaze between Hall and the coffee. Hall explains that the lawyers have been his customers for 15 years and that he's waiting to give them what they ordered the day before. He tells her again that he's been working in this neighborhood for 4 decades. He reiterates that he doesn't press, that he's not one of those pushy salesmen, that he simply has some products that might be useful, and that he can tell her about them in just a few minutes and not waste any of her time. Drip, drip, the coffee is done. "Well," says the woman, stretching the word for long enough that an outright no becomes a grudging maybe, "stop by on your way out." Hall asks her name. It's Beth. She exits with her fresh cup of coffee. Silence fills the room. Hall waits until Beth is out of earshot. Then he leans toward me across the break room table. "That," he says, "is how it starts." Norman Hall began selling Fuller brushes because he was broke. Born in New York City, the son of a Russian mother who took care of the household and a Scottish father who was a sales representative for a publishing company, Hall worked some as a child actor. But upon graduating from high school, he enrolled at Cornell University intent on becoming a doctor. "It quickly became apparent that medicine wasn't my best vocation," he told me. "I spent more time performing than studying." After a stint in the U.S. Navy, he returned to New York City to give professional acting a serious try. It was difficult. In need of steady income, he followed his father's path and became a salesman for a publishing company. Before long, he found himself in San Francisco, opening the West Coast office of Grove Press, the imprint that published Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs, and Allen Ginsberg. In a few years, that office cratered. So did Hall's marriage. He started a restaurant which flopped and burned through his savings. It was the early 1970s, and I was down to my last buck, Hall said. I answered an ad for Fuller Brushes because it offered very fast turnover and quick cash flow. He quit 4 times the first week. Although he'd been a salesperson before, and therefore had met with his full share of rejection, he found door-to-door selling especially brutal. These rejections came fast and ferociously, often in the form of a rude comment and a slammed door. But every time he wanted to quit, one of the San Francisco office's veteran salesmen pulled him aside. This fellow, Charlie was his name, was the quintessential Fuller Brushman, Hall said. He encouraged Hall, telling him that the no's he was piling up were just part of the process and that he should keep going, keep going. By God, at the end of the week, I had a nice wage for myself, Hall said. Hall did keep going, still trying his hand at acting and looking for other ways to support himself. It was a day-to-day thing, he said. But after about 5 years, I finally reconciled to the fact that this is my career and I just do a damn good job of it. Not that it's ever easy. But what wears him down isn't lugging boxes of hairbrushes and bottles of stain remover up and down roller coastery hills or trekking 5 miles a day on 75-year-old legs. It's something deeper. Each day when he makes his round, Hall confronts what he calls an ocean of rejection. Draw a map of the world of selling, and the most prominent topographical feature is that deep and menacing ocean. Anyone who sells, whether they're trying to convince customers to make a purchase or colleagues to make a change, must contend with wave after wave of rebuffs, refusals, and repudiations. How to stay afloat amid that ocean of rejection is the second essential quality in moving others. I call this quality buoyancy. Hall exemplifies it. Recent social science explains it. And if you understand buoyancy's three components, which apply before, during, and after any effort to move others, you can use it effectively in your own life. Before. Interrogative self-talk. The hardest part of selling, Norman Hall says, occurs before his well-polished shoes even touched the streets of San Francisco. Just getting myself out of the house and facing people is the stiffest challenge, he says. It's that big, unknown, faceless person I have to face for the first time. Most sales and success gurus offer a standard remedy for Hall's hesitation. He should pump himself up. He should take a moment to remind himself how fabulous and unstoppable he is. For example, Og Mandino, whose inspirational books help set the tone for sales advice in the 20th century, recommended that we each should tell ourselves, I am nature's greatest miracle, and that I will be the greatest salesman the world has ever known. Napoleon Hill, author of Think and Grow Rich, one of the best-selling American books of the last century, wrote that the first step in salesmanship was autosuggestion, the principle through which the salesman saturates his own mind with belief in the commodity or service offered for sale, as well as in his own ability to sell. From Anthony Robbins in the United States, to Paul McKenna in the United Kingdom, to any sales training course anywhere in the world, the advice arrives with remarkable sameness. Tell yourself you can do it. Declaring an unshakable belief in your inherent awesomeness inflates a sturdy raft that can keep you bobbing in an ocean of rejection. Alas, the social science shows something different and more nuanced. We human beings talk to ourselves all the time. So much, in fact, that it's possible to categorize our self-talk. Some of it is positive, as in, I'm strong, I've got this, or I will be the world's greatest salesman. Some of it, for a few of us, much of it, is negative. I'm too weak to finish this race. I've never been good at math. There's no way I can sell these encyclopedias. But whether the talk is chest thumping or ego bashing, it tends to be declarative. It states what is or what will be. However, the person whose example you should be following takes a different tack. His name is Bob the Builder. And if you haven't been around preschool children in the last 15 years, let me offer a quick dossier. Bob is an overall clad, hard hat sporting, stop motion animated guy who runs a construction company. His TV program, which began in England in 1999, now entertains kids in 45 countries. Bob is always finding himself in sticky situations that seem inevitably to call for traditional sales or non-sales selling. Like all of us, Bob talks to himself. But Bob's self-talk is neither positive nor declarative. Instead, to move himself and his team, he asks a question. Can we fix it? Devotees of Mandino, Hill, Robbins, and McKenna might shudder at allowing this shaft of doubt, questioning one's ability to shine through our psychic windows. But social scientists are discovering that Bob has it right. Yes, positive self-talk is generally more effective than negative self-talk, but the most effective self-talk of all doesn't merely shift emotions, it shifts linguistic categories. It moves from making statements to asking questions. Three researchers, Ibrahim Sané and Dolores Albarracin of the University of Illinois, along with Kenji Noguchi of the University of Southern Mississippi, confirmed the efficacy of interrogative self-talk in a series of experiments they conducted in 2010. In one, they gave participants 10 anagrams to solve. For instance, rearranging the letters in the word when to spell the word hewn. They separated these participants into two groups, each of which was treated identically except for the 1 minute before they tackled their assignments. The researchers instructed the first group to ask themselves whether they would solve the puzzles, and the second group to tell themselves that they would solve the puzzles. On average, the self-questioning group solved nearly 50% more puzzles than the self-affirming group. In the next experiment, the researchers presented a new group of participants with another round of anagrams, but they added a twist of trickery. We told participants that we were interested in people's handwriting practices. With this pretense, participants were given a sheet of paper to write down 20 times one of the following word pairs. Will I will, I, or will. The outcome was similar. People who'd written will I solved nearly twice as many anagrams as those who'd written I will, or I. In subsequent experiments, the basic pattern held. Those who approached a task with Bob the Builder questioning self-talk outperformed those who employed the more conventional juice myself up declarative self-talk. The reasons are twofold. First, the interrogative, by its very form, elicits answers. And within those answers are strategies for actually carrying out the task. Imagine, for instance, that you're readying yourself for an important meeting in which you must pitch an idea and marshal support for it. You could tell yourself, I'm the best. This is going to be a breeze. And that might give you a short-term emotional boost. But if you instead ask, can I make a great pitch? The research has found that you provide yourself something that reaches deeper and lasts longer. You might respond to yourself, well, yes, I can make a great pitch. In fact, I've probably pitched ideas at meetings 24 times in my life. You might remind yourself of your preparation. Sure, I can do this. I know this material inside and out, and I've got some great examples to persuade the people who might be skeptical. You might also give yourself specific tactical advice. At the last meeting like this, I spoke too quickly, so this time I'll slow down. Sometimes in these situations, I get flustered by questions, so this time I'll take a breath before responding. Mere affirmation feels good, and that helps. But it doesn't prompt you to summon the resources and strategies to actually accomplish the task. The second reason is related. Interrogative self-talk, the researchers say, may inspire thoughts about autonomous or intrinsically motivated reasons to pursue a goal. As ample research has demonstrated, people are more likely to act and to perform well when the motivations come from intrinsic choices rather than from extrinsic pressures. Declarative self-talk risks bypassing one's motivations. Questioning self-talk elicits the reasons for doing something and reminds people that many of those reasons come from within. To help get us out of the door, then, the first component in buoyancy is interrogative self-talk. Can you do that? Well, you'll have to ask yourself. During positivity ratios. I'm pretty sure Norman Hall is an ambivert. A few days in his company proves he's not a hardcore introvert. Besides, he couldn't have earned a living selling brushes for 40 years if he were skittish about speaking up or uncomfortable around strangers. But Hall isn't exactly a wrist-grabbing, backslapping extrovert either. He's thoughtful, deliberate, and, as he often describes himself, soft-spoken. I hate salesmen who are used car types who press and press and press, and I don't want to be one of those guys, he told me. I am more soft-spoken in my work than in my real life. Like all effective sellers, Hall is a master of attunement. He listens and observes more than the stereotypical yap-yapping salesman, but he also adds his voice and makes his case with vigor when the situation demands. And if you watch his ambiversion in action and listen carefully to what he says and how he interacts with others, he also demonstrates the second component of buoyancy, positivity. Positivity is one of those words that make many of us roll our eyes, gather our belongings, and look for the nearest exit. It has the saccharine scent of the pumped up and dumbed down, an empty concept pushed by emptier people. But a host of recent research testifies to its importance in many realms of life, including how we move others. Consider, for instance, a difficult negotiation in which each side is trying to sell the other on its position. The conventional view holds that negotiators shouldn't necessarily be nasty and brutish, but they should remain tough-minded and poker-faced. A few years ago, a team of behavioral scientists led by Shirley Koppelman of the University of Michigan tested this proposition by simulating a series of negotiations. In one experiment, they presented their participants, executives who were pursuing MBAs, with the following scenario. You're planning a wedding. Several weeks ago, you'd made provisional arrangements with a catering company that had provided a good faith estimate of $14,000 for its services. Now you are about to meet the caterer's business manager, who's come bearing bad news. Because of market fluctuations, the estimate has increased to $16,995. What's more, the caterer has another client ready to take the date if you don't sign the contract. Unbeknownst to the participants, they'd been divided into three groups. And while the business manager, a specially trained actor, gave each of the three groups precisely the same explanation for the changed price and offered identical terms and conditions for the catering, she varied her emotional approach. To one group, she displayed positive emotions. She spoke with a friendly tone, smiled often, nodded her head in agreement, and appeared cordial and inviting. To another, she spoke antagonistically, appeared intimidating, and was insistent. To the final group, she used an even and monotonic voice, displayed little emotion, and spoke in a pragmatic manner. The business manager's affect had a significant effect. Those who'd heard the positive inflected pitch were twice as likely to accept the deal as those who'd heard the negative one, even though the terms were identical. In a subsequent similar experiment, in which negotiators were able to make counteroffers, those who dealt with the negative person made far less generous counteroffers than those dealing with someone positive on the other side of the table. Barbara Fredrickson of the University of North Carolina is the leading researcher on positivity. Her catch-all term for a basket of emotions including amusement, appreciation, joy, interest, gratitude, and inspiration. Negative emotions, she says, evolve to narrow people's vision and propel their behavior toward survival in the moment. I'm frightened, so I'll flee. I'm angry, so I'll fight. By contrast, positive emotions do the opposite. They broaden people's ideas about possible actions, opening our awareness to a wider range of thoughts and making us more receptive and more creative, she writes. The broadening effect of positive emotions has important consequences for moving others. Consider both sides of a typical transaction. For the seller, positive emotions can widen her view of her counterpart and a situation. Where negative emotions help us see trees, positive ones reveal forests. And that, in turn, can aid in devising unexpected solutions to the buyer's problem. Other studies show that positive emotions can expand our behavioral repertoires and heighten intuition and creativity, all of which enhance our effectiveness. What's more, as we saw in Koppelman's study, emotions can be contagious. That is, the effects of positivity during a sales encounter infect the buyer, making him less adversarial, more open to possibility, and perhaps willing to reach an agreement in which both parties benefit. And when both sides leave the table satisfied, that can establish a sustained relationship and smooth the way for subsequent transactions. Positivity has one other important dimension when it comes to moving others. You have to believe in the product you're selling, and that has to show, Hall says. Nearly every salesperson I talked to disputed the idea that some people, quote, could sell anything, whether they believed in it or not. That may have been true in the past, when sellers held a distinct information advantage and buyers had limited choices. But today, these salespeople told me, believing leads to a deeper understanding of your offering, which allows sellers to better match what they have with what others need. And genuine conviction can also produce emotional contagion of its own. For instance, Corey Shearer and Brad Segarin of Northern Illinois University have found that inserting a mild profanity like damn into a speech increases the persuasiveness of the speech and listeners' perception of the speaker's intensity. I believe in these products, Hall told me. I know damn well that when you buy one of these brushes, you're going to have it for years. But fear not, those who prefer to salt your life stew with several shakes of negativity. Remember, interrogative self-talk is the smart choice when preparing to move someone. And positivity during your efforts doesn't mean coating yourself or others in a thick glaze of sugar. In fact, a particular recipe, a golden ratio of positivity, leads to the best results. In research he carried out with Marcial Losada, a Brazilian social scientist who uses mathematical models and complexity theory to analyze team behavior, Fredrickson had a group of participants record their positive and negative emotions each day for 4 weeks. She and Losada calculated the ratio of positive to negative emotions of the participants and then compared these ratios with the participants' scores on a 33-item measurement of their overall well-being. What they found is that those with an equal, that is, one-to-one, balance of positive and negative emotions had no higher well-being than those whose emotions were predominantly negative. Both groups generally were languishing. Even more surprising, people whose ratio was 2-to-1, positive to negative, were also no happier than those whose negative emotions exceeded their positive ones. But once the balance between emotions hit a certain number, everything tipped. That number was 2.9013, which, for the sake of readers who don't need the precision of the fourth decimal place, Fredrickson and Losada round up to 3. Once positive emotions outnumber negative emotions by 3-to-1, that is, for every 3 instances of feeling gratitude, interest, or contentment, they experienced only 1 instance of anger, guilt, or embarrassment, people generally flourished. Those below that ratio usually did not. But Fredrickson and Losada also found that positivity had an upper limit. Too much can be as unproductive as too little. Once the ratio hit about 11-to-1, positive emotions began doing more harm than good. Beyond that balance of positive to negative, life becomes a festival of Panglossian cluelessness, where self-delusion suffocates self-improvement. Some negativity, what Fredrickson and Losada call appropriate negativity, is essential. Without it, behavior patterns calcify. Negative emotions offer us feedback on our performance, information on what's working and what's not, and hints about how to do better. Hall seems to have found the proper mix. He says that he tries to begin his day with 1 or 2 sales calls that he knows will be friendly. He also seeks positive interactions throughout the day. For instance, in 1 3-hour stretch I was with him, he visited a restaurant to ask after a friend who worked there who'd been ill. He stopped a longtime customer on the street to catch up on what was going on in his life. He entered a clothing store, was greeted by its proprietor with a hearty, "Mr. Fuller!" And the two embraced, albeit in an awkward bro hug. These experiences help him keep going, after other visits, where he leaves muttering under his breath at people's rudeness. Fredrickson sees the healthy positivity ratios of Hall and others as a calibration between 2 competing pulls, levity and gravity. Levity is that unseen force that lifts you skyward, whereas gravity is the opposing force that pulls you earthward. Unchecked levity leaves you flighty, ungrounded, and unreal. Unchecked gravity leaves you collapsed in a heap of misery, she writes. Yet when properly combined, these two opposing forces leave you buoyant. After. Explanatory style.